Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the theme will be an update on conditions in Syria. On the ground, witnessing firsthand the reality. My guest is Vanessa Beely, B-E-E-L-E-Y. Vanessa is a British investigative journalist focusing on the conflicts in the Middle East, particularly in Syria, Gaza, and Yemen. She's an associate editor of 21st Century Wire and was a member of a peace-finding mission to Syria organized by the U.S. Peace Council. She is a contributing writer for the Global Campaign to Return to Palestine, the Dissident Voice, as well as she manages the website The Wall Will Fall, where she blogs about her travels and reports from the Middle East. Vanessa recently returned from another fact-finding mission in Syria this past weekend. She'll be providing a bird's-eye analysis of what currently is happening in the war-torn nation. She was a finalist for the prestigious Martha Gellhorn Prize for Journalism, which has previously been awarded to Robert Perry, Patrick Coburn, Robert Fisk, and others. Her website is thewallwillfall.org. Nice to have you with us today again, Vanessa.
Thank you so much for inviting me back on, Gary. It's a pleasure to be here.
You just returned from another tour through Syria to continue your investigative reporting on conditions in the country and to speak with the Syrian people who have been victimized by the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and other countries, as well as the rebel and terrorist organizations that our nation and those nations I just mentioned all supports. I'd like to look at the larger picture of the terrorist organizations and why in America we say we're fighting terrorists and yet we support terrorists. And the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, CNN, MSNBC, these are all supposed to be and historically have supported humanitarian causes, looking for the larger good in any situation. Here, I believe that there's been an abject failure for them to either investigate honestly or report accurately on how it is that we're funding terrorists instead of helping to eliminate terrorism. That's one issue I'd like for you to cover. Also, I would like for you to share some of the newer revelations you have discovered during your travels. In fact, the biggest event is probably the ISIS massacre of villagers and large kidnappings of women that took place as an orchestrated night raid in Sweda and surrounding villages. 270 people were killed, over 300 injured. None of this was reported in our media. None. So what did your investigation discover, and what is the most compelling evidence to date that the United States and its allies are aiding ISIS in particular, because it seems that from your reports, the ISIS terrorists were arriving from the direction of the U.S. military base in Tel al-Saifa. The forum is yours.
Thank you so much, Gary. I mean, first of all, coming to your question about the financing of the terrorist organizations, and I'd like to cover the situation, the current situation in Idlib, because there's a lot of very confusing information regarding this particular province, which was set to be the final battle for the liberation of Syrian territory from terrorist occupation led by Nusra Front under the rebranding of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS, as it's known in the Western media now. When I arrived in Syria, the potential for the battles to liberate Idlib was still simmering. This was prior to the agreement between Turkey and Russia to set up the deconfliction zone, which is due to come to completion, I believe, in a few days on October the 15th, when the terrorist groups, so that will include the Al-Qaeda-controlled groups and their splinter factions, should have divested themselves of their heavy weapons, meaning their Grad missiles, their multi-rocket launchers, their RPGs, etc., and withdrawn from the deconfliction zone, which is around, I think, 15 to 20 kilometers deep. Now, prior to that agreement being in place, I had actually visited two Christian towns right on the border with Idlib, north of Hama province, inside Syria. And the day I visited the town of Mahade, they'd come under attack the day before that by Jaish al-Islam and Nusra Front groups. Jaish al-Islam, of course, had been the occupying group in the suburb of Douma, which, of course, was the scene of the staging of the chemical weapon event by the White Helmets and associated Western-backed and sponsored groups inside Eastern Ghouta, just as Eastern Ghouta was being liberated April this year. So Jaish al-Islam, Nusra Front, led an attack against the Christian town of Mahade. They launched, I believe it was 9 Grad missiles, a number of which contained cluster bomblets, into civilian areas. So I arrived literally the day after this attack, when 9 civilians had been massacred by this attack, including one man, Shadi, who lost his mother, his wife, and his 3 children in that attack. And over the next few days, I visited other injured civilians in the hospital in Mahade itself. Over the next few days, another 4 died from their injuries, including a 15-year-old boy, Ibrahim, who I saw in hospital. Shrapnel had passed from the back of his head and exited out the front, so it had basically passed through his brain. He didn't regain consciousness. He died in hospital. So this massacre against not military targets, but against civilian targets, Christian civilian targets inside Syria on the borders with Idlib, was carried out by the terrorist groups that are described as moderate rebels by Western media. And there was very little Western media outrage at the fact that these terrorist groups had somehow received supply not only of Grad missiles and the ability to launch multiple Grad missiles, but Grad missiles containing cluster bomblets, which, of course, that is an international war crime when used against civilian targets. Of course, the US has very little moral repugnance about this, as it's already using or in supplying cluster munitions to the Saudi coalition, which, again, are being used against civilian targets in Yemen. The day after that, another Christian town, Al-Skelbiye, which is very close to Mahade, and again around 500 to 700 meters from the terrorist front lines in Idlib, I actually walked to within 500 meters of those front lines, and I could see the Nusra Front checkpoints from where I was standing in Al-Skelbiye, the Christian town that was attacked two days after Mahade. Again, they were attacked with the same cluster munitions that were used in Mahade. I arrived again the day after. I was able to see actually the Russian bomb disposal units detonating those cluster bomblets in the center of Skelbiye, in actual apartment buildings where those rockets had been had landed. So my point was that prior to this agreement, which ensured the deconfliction zone, these Christian towns and a number of other bordering towns were under consistent attack by these terrorists that are receiving arms via the Turkish border. They're receiving financial aid and equipment, of course, particularly through my government, through what they euphemistically call humanitarian aid, that has been proven to be coming into the terrorist groups under the cover of being for a number of NGOs and supposed civil society organizations such as the local councils, the White Helmets, the Free Syrian Police, etc. And the proof of that, of course, is in the Dutch government, or the Netherlands government, very recently, withdrawing or suspending funding to the White Helmets and to the intermediary that was set up by the creator of the White Helmets, a former MI6 agent, James Le Mesurier, to funnel funds from the British government to the White Helmets. That organization is called Mayday Rescue. It was actually established originally in Dubai. It is now registered in the Netherlands. And the Dutch government, after pressure over a number of years, actually, by activists and journalists inside Holland, have actually withdrawn that funding on the basis that they cannot guarantee that that financing, which was considerable, well over 12 million, I believe, although I have seen some higher figures being bandied about, that figure, they had no assurances from either Mayday Rescue, from the White Helmets, or from any of the other NGOs that they were passing this money to, that it was not ending up in the hands of the terrorist groups. Also, while I was there, I went into Sinjar, which is to the east of Idlib province, and that is actually back under the control of the Syrian Arab Army. Now, that area has been receiving a number of refugees from Idlib itself, escaping the terrorist occupation. What they told us, and of course, again, this will not be reported in Western media, is that the humanitarian corridor that again has been set up by the Russian reconciliation teams alongside the Syrian army and the Syrian government, as they have been in all other liberation areas like Eastern Ghouta, like East Aleppo, etc., in order to try and preserve civilian life, in order to try and give civilians the opportunity to escape the terrorist occupied territories before they are liberated. But what we were told by civilians who had made it out was that the terrorist groups, of course, again, I emphasize, they are led and largely dominated by Nusra Front and its affiliates. But civilians who managed to escape told us that those groups had been shelling the humanitarian corridor as civilians were trying to leave, just as they did, of course, in East Aleppo and Eastern Ghouta. And they were charging upwards of $600 for civilians to be able to leave. Of course, what this does is ensure that the majority of civilians are unable to leave and will remain as hostages or as human shields for those terrorist groups leading up to any military campaign to liberate those areas. And again, this is, you know, I keep saying it, but this is a repetition of the situation in Eastern Ghouta and in East Aleppo. Both liberation campaigns, I was present in Syria during those campaigns. So what I'm trying to present here is the picture of events leading up to the agreement between Turkey and Russia to create this deconfliction zone, and to what extent, for civilians, this deconfliction zone has been a huge relief. It stopped, actually, since that came into place, there have been no further attacks on the Christian towns of Mohade and Skelbie. What I will say, of course, is we're nearing the completion point, the 15th of October. We have been told of movement in the border areas in Idlib. We've been told that, for example, groups like Arar Sham, who are considered slightly more moderate than Nusra Front, but who have nevertheless carried out ethnic cleansing pogroms across Syria, have been moving out of some of the border areas and have been replaced by Nusra Front, who are moving in with heavy weaponry. So there appears to be some degree of escalation of military movement by the more extremist groups in certain areas. So this is something to be noted leading up to what is the sort of the final date to achieve fully this deconfliction zone. What I was also told by civilians who had managed to escape Idlib was that a number of civilians, the majority of whom were children, had been kidnapped in the last 7 or 8 months in preparation, of course, for the staged chemical weapon attacks that would have been implemented had the Syrian army gone ahead with its liberation campaign in Idlib. And we know that the US coalition, particularly the UK, the US and France, were waiting in the wings to carry out another unlawful aggression against Syria were those chemical attacks to be reported by, of course, the favorite propaganda producers, the White Helmets on the ground in Idlib. We were told of children being kidnapped. I spoke to one family whose child had been kidnapped in just before February 2018. I had a history from them of sightings of their child as he was being moved around different areas in Idlib in preparation, as they believed, for a chemical weapon attack staging. They told me very clearly that it was the White Helmets that were moving these children from one place to another upon the orders of Nusra Front and other extremist groups who were planning to stage the events in order to incur the attacks from the US coalition. So what the deconfliction zone did basically was to push back against this initiative by the US coalition to ensure the pretext that would enable them to carry out further aggression against Syria. Of course, the response from Israel to the deconfliction zone, which was on the night that zone was agreed, Israel attacked the coastal town of Latakia. I was actually in Damascus around 10:30 at night when the attack started to be reported. And that, of course, was what led to the bringing down of the Russian warplane with 15 Russian personnel on board. Since then, of course, we've had Russia ensuring the supply of the S-300 air defense systems into Syria, which is a clear message being sent out to Israel that they should cease invading Syrian airspace upon the pretext, of course, of targeting Iranian weapon supply to Hezbollah inside Syria. So again, this has created another pivotal balancing point in the conflict where Russia has taken, again, control. It is protecting, of course, its own military interests, but of course it's also increasing Syria's ability to defend itself against what are illegal violations of Syrian airspace, not only by Israel, but potentially by members of the US coalition as well. In the northeast, of course, we still have the US occupying areas of the northeast, not only, as you mentioned, in the Al-Tanf base, which is on the border with Iraq, but also via their proxies in the SDF, which are around 80% YPG. We've seen reports in the last couple of days that the US is bringing weapons and equipment in to further power multiply the SDF in that region, which of course again is the oil rich region in Syria. So it's clear that the US is not thinking about leaving that area anytime soon, despite some degree of reassurances from Trump at various points in the last year or so. We also hear that Russia is building up troops in the southeastern areas of Deir ez-Zor. Of course, this area is still to a degree and has a degree of ISIS occupation close to US bases, not only Al-Tanf, but close to the US proxy bases, i.e. the SDF bases, but also close to the Al-Tanf base. And this brings me on, as you quite rightly say, to the recent Sweida massacre. Sweida is a province to the south of Damascus. It's a very loyal province to the Syrian government. And on the 25th of July of this year, ISIS terrorists came in from the northeast. So they came in from the direction of Al-Tanf, from the direction of the U.S. base. Although the U.S. base is around, just to give your listeners a sort of a placement, it's around 330 kilometers from the site of the attack. But nevertheless, these ISIS fighters moved across open ground, desert, during the night, quite big numbers of them. without being spotted or without being attacked by the US coalition that must surely have known of their movements. So they came in from the northeast. They entered seven towns in the eastern Sueda countryside, and they also entered Sueda city with a number of suicide cars and bombers. They came in at around 4 a.m. in the morning. That night, I was told there was no moon, so they came in under the cover of darkness. They entered the homes on the outskirts of the villages and massacred civilians, including children. In Shpeki, one of the villages where I spoke to civilians, I was told that even a disabled child was executed as he lay sleeping by the ISIS terrorists. Some of the atrocities that were carried out are absolutely horrifying. This was one of the most, one of the bloodiest massacres of this 8-year war in Syria, and it went largely unreported by Western media. 270 civilians were massacred, many of them children. The ISIS terrorists surrounded each of the villages. The villages are around 1 kilometer apart in a pretty much straight line. So they surrounded each of the villages with snipers. They set up snipers along the roads that connected the villages. So basically, if anyone tried to come from a neighboring village to help their relatives in another village, they were unable to, and they were sniped as they tried to reach a village, or, of course, as they tried to leave the villages with injured family members in their cars, they were fired upon. In fact, as I entered one village, I saw a car that had been sniped multiple times. It had three civilians on board who were already injured and who were being taken to hospital. It was then hit by an RPG by the ISIS terrorists, and basically the occupants were instantly killed. The attacks went on from about 4 a.m. until, I was told, around 1 p.m. in the afternoon, when actually the civilians, despite having very, very basic weapons such as hunting rifles and so on, managed to drive the ISIS terrorists out of their homes and out of their villages. But as I said, 270 civilians were killed. The majority of them, as I was told, bled to death in the streets because nobody could get to them. If they tried to get to them, they would be sniped also. So at around 1 p.m., the ISIS terrorists were driven out, but they took with them, at that point, 32 kidnapped victims. A number of those kidnapped victims, through various means, managed to escape their ISIS captors and to make it back to their villages under the cover of darkness of the following night. However, 25 of those kidnapped victims are still missing. They're suspected to have been taken to Tilal al-Safa, an area which is on the way to the U.S. base, so about 70 kilometers to the northeast. One of those kidnapped victims was executed by ISIS, I think it was about 4 or 5 days ago now. And, of course, the hopes are that the Syrian Arab Army campaign that is now underway to cleanse that area of the ISIS terrorist group will discover the whereabouts of the kidnapped victims and be able to return them to Sueda. But what is very important here is to point out that not only did those ISIS terrorists manage to cover a pretty big area without being detected or fired upon by the U.S. coalition, they also fled in the direction of the U.S. base because they know that the Syrian Arab Army and its allies are not able to enter the buffer zone around the Al-Tanf U.S. base because they will then be fired upon. I mean, this is the extraordinary situation where the U.S. coalition has effectively occupied and has set up an illegal military base on sovereign nation territory and is then defending that base and firing upon the Syrian Arab Army that is battling ISIS in that area. So effectively they're giving shelter to the ISIS terrorists. This is not the first time that the US has worked in collusion with ISIS. There have been reports on a number of occasions, including in the last 2 days, that the US has been airlifting ISIS fighters out of areas where the Syrian Arab Army is closing in. Of course, in September 2016, the US coalition, and that included the UK and Australia, I believe, bombed for 1 hour Syrian Arab Army positions overlooking Deir ez-Zor, where they were battling ISIS. And that bombing by the US not only massacred over 70 Syrian Arab Army soldiers defending civilians against ISIS, but also enabled ISIS to move forward and temporarily to take strategic ground close to Deir ez-Zor, which put civilians at risk. The other thing that I was told when I was inside Sweda and investigating the attack was that the opinion of many of the residents in Sweda and many military analysts also inside Syria, that this attack was to relieve the pressure on the ISIS fighters in the Yarmouk Basin, which was to the south of Damascus, that was on the verge of being fully liberated by the Syrian Arab Army, to relieve the pressure, to force the Syrian Arab Army to lift the siege on the Yarmouk Basin and to allow the ISIS fighters to exit, towards Al-Tanf, so towards the US base. So whatever way we look at this, there appears to be collusion between the US coalition, the US base in Al-Tanf, and the maneuvers of the ISIS terrorists. Another point that was made was that the ISIS terrorists were incredibly well equipped. They had very modern, state-of-the-art equipment. Many of them were high on drugs, which we would assume to be Captagon from the description by civilians of how they fired bullets into these fighters and they still kept coming, which is something that I've heard across Syria. That these terrorist groups are being given Captagon, which is a battle performance enhancer. It basically prevents the inhibiting of adrenaline, so the adrenaline keeps rising, which means that they feel no pain, which means that they can continue fighting even when they are being shot at. So all of these elements, when brought together, must surely raise questions about to what extent is the US coalition really fighting terrorism inside Syria? And let's remember that we cannot even get away with calling ISIS a moderate or a rebel. ISIS is the reason that the US is allegedly inside Syria to battle this group. And yet, consistently, time and time again, we've seen collusion and collaboration, not only between the US and ISIS, but also between the SDF and ISIS. Particularly in the taking over of territory in the northeast by the SDF on behalf of the United States.
Okay, that's a really in-depth discussion, almost 29 minutes. If you've just tuned in, yeah, that's all right. If you've just tuned in, you've been listening to an in-depth, first-hand report from the battlefield in Syria. At the same time that Vanessa Vili has been telling us the truth, all the U.S. media, following talking points, clearly from the White House, the State Department, the Defense Intelligence Agencies, the Pentagon, are all of one mind that Bashar Assad, the president of Syria, is with Russia and Iran, is laying siege for the final kill in this particular village without mentioning the truth of any of this. You have not heard any of this information before. That said, there is absolute evidence now, irrefutable, that the U.S.-backed rebels are drug addicts. You heard her mention that the drug most likely is Captagon, C-A-P-T-A-G-O-N, and for the reasons she said. It's an amphetamine-like synthetic stimulant, and it recalls the Hashishim, the drug-induced assassins who were the world's first terrorists in the 12th century, Iraq at the time of the Crusades. And so if you shoot one of these people, they're likely not to go down because they're not going to feel the pain. I did a little research and discovered that according to studies at the Scripps Research Institute, Captagon acts faster and is much stronger than amphetamines alone. It's been illegal in the United States since the early 1980s, and so she is giving us an insight that that's the likely reason that it's being used, and also that they're so well equipped. How does an organization have the state-of-the-art equipment unless somehow, directly or indirectly, we manage to put it in their hands? Also, Vanessa, I'd like for you to talk about, take a side step for a moment. Assad has been demonized. He's been called one of the axis of evil, like Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein and the head of North Korea. And yet people who I've spoken with, including four different journalists who've met with him, said that he's unpretentious. He lives a relatively normal life, is not surrounded by dozens of protectors, like the Secret Service protects the President of the United States, and he's relatively accessible, as is his wife. They're both highly educated, and if they were living in the United States and participating in our body politic, they would be considered more progressive than right wing or left wing. Now, I have not met the person, so I cannot make any judgment, but tell us your impressions of the couple.
Well, I had the great fortune, of course, with the U.S. Peace Council to meet with President Assad for 2 hours. I would certainly echo what your other guests have said to you, that he is decidedly unpretentious, very humble, very open. I don't think that was one question that he dodged or did not answer very directly and in a very detailed manner. But I think, you know, what is very important to mention here is that, of course, in the West, you know, when they are engaging in one of these so-called humanitarian interventions, or whether it is military or economic, or in the case of Syria, of course, both, both crippling economic sanctions and military intervention via proxy terrorist groups and directly via the U.S. coalition, there is always this, what I call Hitlerization of the leader of that target nation. We've seen this throughout history, you know, whether it's Milosevic, whether it's Saddam Hussein, whether it's Gaddafi, and many others. But I think what is a very important point to make inside Syria is that it is not about one man. It is not about President Assad. It is about the Syrian people fighting for the survival of their secular culture and society. And were President Assad to, heaven forbid, disappear tomorrow, the Syrian people would keep fighting the terrorist invasion of their country that has effectively been sponsored and financed and planned well before 2011 by governments in the US and in the UK. We have the Bush-Blair communiques that made it very clear that Syria was in the crosshairs. There was a Time article in 2006 which was actually called Syria in Bush's Crosshairs. You know, historically, if we go back through the archives and even through the released documents that have come out via WikiLeaks, we know that this entire uprising as such was planned to be armed and power multiplied by the US coalition in order to overthrow and topple what they perceived to be a recalcitrant, independent government that did not kowtow to the US supremacism in the region, and also historically had been a nemesis of Israel, had been a very strong supporter of the Palestinian cause. but also who threatened unity in the region. Of course, you know, we talk about the partitioning of Syria, but of course the entire region throughout history has been partitioned in order to weaken its strength as a region. And of course, what Syria was threatening to do was to reunite that region. I mean, we've seen recently a much stronger unity between Iraq and Syria. We've seen the healing of relationships between Lebanon and Syria. We've seen the threat of opening trade routes with Jordan, for example. We know at the moment that the US is fundamentally putting pressure on Jordan not to open those trade routes. So, you know, what this has been effectively has been a war of attrition against an entire nation, not only against one man. And my opinion on this is that the majority of the Syrian people support President Assad. So as far as I am concerned, that is what we should be defending and supporting, the right of these Syrian people to determine their own future. Let me give you an example of how Syria operates, contrary to what we're told. Very recently, there was what was called Decree 16 was brought out. Decree 16 caused a certain degree of protest within Syria itself, because it was basically sympathizing with some of the more Islamist extremist elements within Syria. It was an effort to reconcile with those elements that had potentially taken up arms and gone against the government. Now, today, I was told by a Syrian friend of mine that there was a lengthy debate in parliament. And that decree, over 75% of it, has been rendered null and void. So this is the process in Syria. This is actually a democratic process unraveling as we're sitting here. And yet we are told consistently that this country is a dictatorship, that it's an authoritarian tyrant that is in charge. But let me tell you, I visited areas on this last trip. All of us as journalists have to enter these areas with some degree of security, because this is still a war zone. For example, when I went into Sweida, yes, I had somebody with me from military security, because there are still sleeper cells in this area. So for my own safety, I am accompanied on these trips, but I am not hobbled in any way as regards who I can interview. And a number of people actually criticized President Assad publicly to me. But let me tell you how I interpret that. They criticize him because they see him as the father of this country. We have to get ourselves out of this Western mindset. The Middle Eastern culture is such that the father is the head of the family. And whatever anybody does within that family, they can fight with the father, they can protest against the father, but ultimately the father is the one they go to resolve their difficulties. And even these people, in criticizing and saying, we haven't got this, we need water, we need electricity, at the end of what they said, they basically then said, but we know, we trust in our president to supply this to us, we just hope he does it sooner rather than later. So what I see all the time is, despite the hideous pressures that are being put upon this society, and the majority of those pressures, I have to say, come from the economic sanctions that are affecting the humanitarian sectors, the hospital sectors, the ability of the Syrian state to take care of its people. Those people who might complain about the lack of services, who might complain about the pressures upon their life, still look to President Assad to solve those difficulties. Is this the reaction of a people who are fighting against a tyrant? That they feel that they can not only criticize him, but they can still look to him for advice and for help? This is something that I really want people to understand. The way that President Assad is viewed by the majority of his people is nothing it has no relation to how it is described in the media in the West.
Vanessa, what do you make of the way that Assad lives? Could you briefly, just briefly, describe how he lives compared to other major leaders around the world?
Well, I mean, you know, his life is actually, as far as I can see, very, very simple. His wife is an absolute workaholic. I know people who work as volunteers in one of her NGOs. And even though she is now currently undergoing cancer treatment, she is still working and putting in a full working day. Among the NGOs that she runs is one that takes care of the reconciliation process for women in particular, women whose husbands have taken up arms and joined some of the terrorist groups. So those women are rehabilitated via this organization. They're given training in order to be able to earn money to keep their families afloat. The president moves around Syria with, as you said before, with very little security. He entered Ghouta, for example, during the liberation, not even right at the end of liberation. So there was serious threat of an assassination attempt. We've seen images of him entering a local market and being literally mobbed by the people in there. All of his public appearances are very simple ones. Both of them appear in sort of not the usual glamorous head of state appearance, but they appear very simply dressed. They go to some of the more remote regions of Syria in order to speak with, for example, the families of martyrs in the Syrian Arab Army. They're very much hands-on leaders of a country who don't have any of the, let's say, the luxury airs and graces that we see, for example, in the US or in the UK or in Europe. Very down to earth, very down to earth.
You were in Leucadia, which is right on the Syrian coast and very close to a Russian military base, when Israel led a bombing raid, and this occurred just hours after Putin and Turkey agreed to on a ceasefire. Yet Israel has been periodically conducting air raids over Syria for quite a while, and Russia has blamed Netanyahu for Syria's military intrusion before. And we're being told that the reason is because Iranian troops and personnel on the ground in Syria to support Assad's forces. You have discerned this. Is it true or not? And can you explain the relationship between Assad and the Iranian government? Because some critics argue that toppling Assad is one step closer to focusing military aggression on Iran.
I wasn't actually in Latakia when the attack was carried out. I was in Damascus, but obviously the news was coming in minute by minute as the attack was conducted. The claim was that they hit what was effectively, I believe, originally an aluminium factory, which Israel claimed to be a weapons base for Iranian-backed militants. I haven't had any confirmation of that claim by Israel. So, and I was told it was still an aluminium factory. So that's all I can really tell you on that. I didn't actually manage to go there and ascertain the truth of one side or the other. But one point, I would certainly say that the conflict in Syria has, you know, if we go back again to the communiques between Bush and Blair during the Iraq War, so from 2003 onwards, there was a very, very clear strategy to separate Iran from Syria and to weaken that alliance. That emphasis seemed to change earlier this year, I think around February again, 2018, the leaked diplomatic cables from a UK diplomat in Washington, where then the emphasis seemed to be on breaking the alliance between Russia and Syria. So I suppose the conclusions that I would draw from that is that basically they would really much prefer that Syria is isolated and without the powerful allies that it has, that have enabled Syria to push back against the imperialist project in Syria. Coming back to Israel, the point I would make is, again, when I was in the south and I followed the route taken by allegedly the White Helmets, but I also ascertained there that a number of terrorist leaders, including ISIS fighters, were evacuated by Israel via one of their entrances to what is effectively the illegally occupied Golan territory. It became very clear from following that route and going almost as far as the security fence, although of course I couldn't get too far because I probably would have been shot by the Israeli soldiers that were guarding it. Speaking to people in that area, it became very clear there was a hospital there, a three-story hospital that had been dismantled, actually, brick by brick by the terrorists before they left. That hospital was used to treat terrorist fighters that were injured battling the Syrian army. It was strewn, the whole area was strewn with Israeli equipment and Israeli medicine, Israeli food supplies, which is particularly ironic when you consider the siege of Gaza and how Israel is refusing to send any supplies into Gaza and yet is clearly here not only supplying the terrorist groups, the extremist groups, but also then we found out that fighters that were too badly injured were then taken the same route through the Israeli security fence into Israeli hospitals. Now, of course, this had previously been reported, but to actually see it firsthand as I did, to actually see the route that was taken by these terrorist groups, was quite an extraordinary experience. And it just brought home to me to what extent Israel has been involved in this destabilization project. It has been arming, financing, and providing hospital treatment for the terrorist groups, so for extremist groups. And those extremist groups were given expedited evacuation under the banner of the White Helmet pretext. They were given special treatment in being enabled to leave Syria to the safety of Israel and then on to Jordan.
I'm going to deal with 10 of the biggest lies about Assad, that Assad's terrible regime caused the civil war, Assad kills his own people, Assad oppresses minorities, Syrians hate Assad, USA supports the good guys, USA and the United Kingdom got involved only because of atrocities, the White Helmets are awesome and good, that Assad used chemical weapons, and if Assad loses, there will be peace in Syria. Quickly deal with this in just a few moments, because we don't have a lot of time left.
Okay, well, I think my question would be, if that were the case, if that were really the case, why are Syrian refugees, both internally displaced and those who have fled to neighboring countries and even to Europe, and now returning home to the areas that have been liberated by the Syrian Arab army in their droves? Over a million have come back to Aleppo since its liberation in December 2016. Why would those people be coming back to live under the rule of a tyrant, if we are to believe Western media? It is insane to make the claim that the Syrian Arab army would attack and kill its own people. It is the people of Syria. The Syrian Arab army is a conscript army. The national defense forces that I met with in the Christian villages are the young men from those villages who've taken up arms to protect their towns against the terrorist groups that have been sponsored and financed by our governments and described euphemistically as rebels or democracy bringers or moderates. If anybody comes to Syria and speaks to any civilian in those liberated areas that were forced to live under the occupation of the terrorist groups, they will hear from those civilians directly that they were forced to live under a hellish terrorist, extremist, sectarian regime. The liberation comes when they can return to the peace, security, and stability that they had prior to 2011, prior to this fabricated revolution that has plunged Syria into an 8-year war that it would never have chosen to have.
Vanessa, a short answer. We have 5 minutes left. Most of the American liberal media has supported the United States' position in Syria. Virtually 100% of the conservative media, Fox, and they're all making misstatements. But when you, if you had a chance tomorrow to speak directly with Amy Goodman, who, and I'm only singling her out because she is a voice of the left in the United States, the liberal, corporate liberal community, in the George Soros community, and she has been a big supporter of the invasion of Syria and Libya. And she has supported and promoted the White Helmets. Hollywood supported the White Helmets, gave them an Oscar for short documentary. What would you say to her?
I think I would ask her why she has never, as she claims, an objective media outlet with independent views. Why has she never entertained the views of the majority of the Syrian people who have effectively been excluded by platforms like Amy Goodman? Their voices have been silenced. They have not been allowed to speak because allowing them to speak would undermine the regime change project of the US government and its allies in the EU and in the UK, the Gulf states, Turkey, Israel. All of these platforms are effectively anti-war platforms because anybody who believes that war or military intervention is an effective way to bring peace is just living in a neocon globalist echo chamber. And I'm sorry to say this, and I'm going to say it as strongly as this, all of these media outlets, whether they are purportedly liberal media outlets or whether they are mainstream media outlets, have conducted a criminal campaign against the Syrian people that has resulted in the manufacturing of consent of yet another regime change war, the destruction of vast areas of Syria, the decimation of Syrian infrastructure. But I will tell them one thing. They have failed. The Syrian people have proven to be stronger, more united than they could ever have imagined. And their failure will be their downfall because Syria has exposed all of these media outlets to be the hypocrites that they really are.
We have about a minute and a half left. How strong is the rebuilding of Damascus suburbs and other in Aleppo that have been damaged or destroyed during the war?
One of the first things I did when I arrived in Damascus this time is to go to the Damascus International Fair, in fact, the 60th International Fair. I think what was quite extraordinary about this was that last year this fair came under attack. A number of civilians were actually killed at the entrance to the fair by mortars fired from the terrorist-occupied areas of eastern Ghouta. This year, we saw an event that sort of not only promoted Syrian industry, but also clearly had invited a number of its allies to be involved in the rebuilding project. So this was a huge beacon of hope rising out of the ashes of the previous 6 years of terrorist occupation of the suburbs of Damascus. Of course, there are huge areas that have been destroyed, and it is a mammoth task to rebuild. But where my optimism comes from is in revisiting Aleppo and seeing the rebuilding processes going on there. Whole neighborhoods are in the process of being rebuilt. Restaurants have reopened. People are back in public squares that previously were held by terrorist groups. The citadel itself has been restored after the attacks on it by the terrorist groups. The mortar damage to the entrance has been rebuilt. How can I describe it? It's like seeing spring shoots coming through everywhere. When we consider that areas have only been liberated for less than a few months, the streets have already been cleaned, trees are already being replanted, houses are being rebuilt. Syria has an enormous capacity to restore itself, and that is what we are witnessing across all the liberated areas, and I'm quite sure that we will see it throughout Syria.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. That's very positive. Well, the United States government and all the media have been wrong, and as you say, they're on, not just on the wrong side of history, but this shows the lack of a moral basis to their platforms and their philosophy. They're bankrupt. And it's people like you, the Vanessa Beeleys of the world and others, that bring us the truth. And so we again commend you for your courage, your honesty and integrity. And thank you very much. And Vanessa has the website thewallwillfall.org, as well as 21stcenturywire.com. I look forward to another conversation.
Thank you so much, Gary.
I'm Gary Nall, and this has been the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you for listening.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love. Don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Judge us simply cause our hair is long. Oh, you know we've got to find a way. Bring some understanding here today. Oh, oh, oh. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Come on, talk to me. You can't see what's going on.